All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Go Lazio, indeed, as today's show travels back to a time when Eagles Dead, the extraordinary Lazio of the early 70s, described by one incredibly authoritative pundit as the craziest team ever and maybe the most heartbreaking. And featuring, of course, the extraordinary Giorgio Chinaglia, Long John himself, one of South Wales' greatest gifts to the Italian game. Quite a story on the way, plus our thoughts on the title race and Italy's clashes coming up with Argentina and England. That's today's Golazzo. Ciao, James Horncastle.
Hey, James.
And the man who said Lazio are probably the craziest team ever, Gabriele Marcotti.
Willa.
I'm sorry?
I said Willa.
Yeah, indeed.
Sorry, I'm. You guys are big on regional accents and dialects. Mm. Yeah.
So.
Oh, exactly. Nice to see you, Gabriele. And a very special story. We're going to go a little bit further back than we customarily do. We're well outside our kind of 90s comfort zone here, but I think it's well worth it. Because as you were suggesting last week, Gabriele, there are few, if any, teams worldwide who are quite as crazy as this particular gang.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I'm sure we'll get into this, but you know, a team that in a space of 5 years wins promotion, has its manager die, has one of its key players die, gets a three-year ban from European football, has their star player go and nearly incite a riot in a Rome derby, as one Paolo Di Canio would do many years later. A team that's gun-obsessed. Everything is just remarkable about the story. But also, and lost in all this, was also a team that played some pretty nice football at a time when they were one of the first Italian sides to try and go and copy what the Dutch sides were doing, you know, in terms of total football. Now, a lot of people said they played total football at the time and it wasn't quite total football, and Cruyff would probably turn his nose up at it, but at least they tried.
Right. Well, the year is 1973, and while in England Leeds were busy winning the title, Man United were getting relegated, courtesy of Dennis Law, and you had dirty Leeds and the England side not qualifying for the World Cup and all that kind of thing. In Italy, well, it was a nation entering gli anni di piombo, the years of lead, Red Brigade terrorism, neo-fascist terrorism, and the lines between the two getting crossed and blurred again and again, and the peninsula terrorised and polarised, really. And in the capital, the perfect team, the emblematic team, really, of these times, a Lazio squad split down the middle, carrying guns, and about to pull off one of the most remarkable wins ever, led by Long John, Giorgio Chinaglia, who sounded a little bit like this.
Manchester, feeling good, rival team is raving too. On the field, think of you, trainer says some love tonight, all around.
What on earth is that sound, James Horncastle?
It's Football Crazy, Jimbo, by Giorgio Chinaglia, which, as Gab was saying off air, was part of a film. Because Chinaglia, did he star in that film?
In fact, he did, yes.
Mm-hmm. And who was his co-star?
With this obscure actress named Elizabeth Taylor.
Wow.
That's how big it was. I'm serious. Look, we talk about Cristiano today, right?
Yes.
I don't see no Cristiano going in films with Jennifer Lawrence,
well,
right?
Stan Collymore did, what was the name of that film?
Oh, with Sharon Stone, yeah, Basic Instinct 2.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, I guess, a similar
really deal. Seek out the opening scene of that, because it's really something.
It really is.
It's a really great shout, the parallel, the Stan Collymore, Giorgio Chinaglia shout, for everything from sort of politics to larger than life to...
Well, anyway, let's talk a little bit about Chinaglia then, because this is the early 70s. And you hinted at the magnitude of the achievement of that Lazio team, which did a Leicester and so much more.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when people think of Lazio winning titles today, the first team that comes to mind is the Cragnotti era, the 2000 team, which was a super team, you know, which had so much money flung at it in order to assemble this group of superstars. Whereas this really wasn't, you know, it was a bunch of misfits. As Gab said at the top of the show, you know, they won promotion. They didn't sign really anyone from top clubs, like Juventus or Milan. These are all kind of players that either Tommaso Maestrelli, their manager, had worked with in the past with Foggia and took with him, or guys had been really sort of jobbing around the second and third divisions for a long time. Chinalia, for example, was the first ever player to be called up for the national team at senior level whilst he was still playing in Serie B, because he was completely tearing it up in that division, scoring 21 goals. So, you know, in that respect, for them to go, you know, from Serie B to the top flight and challenge for the title up until the final day, where, you know, they had a lot of suspicion about what went on at halftime in the Juventus-Roma game, where, you know, apparently they got together, said, "Man, we can't be having Lazio winning the league. Milan were at this moment in time losing against Verona, and, you know, Juventus come back and win." Although I think Lazio were playing away at Napoli in that game, which was pretty hostile because in the reverse fixture there'd been a massive brawl, as there usually was with this team, in which I think Chinalia had punched the son of Napoli's kind of academy director.
Okay.
And as you do, and you know, there are all sorts, you know, the bus going to the San Paolo had, you know, cans, bottles thrown at it, it was punctured, had to go back. So pretty hostile stuff.
I think Lazio represented a certain type of Italian culture at the time. I mean, obviously, you know, the connotations with the right, the certain sense of entitlement, perhaps, were there. But it was above all, and certainly some players were very clear in identifying as being very pro-right wing at a time when...
One of them later represented the right wing in Parliament.
Just right wing as in kind of conservative, but quite extreme right wing.
Yeah. But I think it also needs to be placed in, again, very much in the context of the time. I mean, you mentioned the terrorism, and that was certainly very true, both Red Brigades on the far left and their equivalents on the far right. But it went right down into the schools. I mean, you know, you regularly had, you know, for whatever reason, you know, students like extremes. You know, I don't know what you were like when you were 18, but you probably weren't like, "Oh, look, I'm centrist James Richardson. You know, look at me, I'm so wonderfully moderate." You know, most people are generally attracted to one end or the other at the spectrum in their youth. And in Italy, that translated a lot of times to fisticuffs. Also, this is also set against the backdrop of the Cold War. You know, Italy having the largest communist party in Western Europe. Mm.
And also the Iron Bloc right on your doorstep, no?
Well, we border Yugoslavia, so you know that was certainly a factor as well. You had kind of, I think, because things back then tended to come late to Italy, you kind of also probably, you know, the 60s hit Italy in some ways a little bit later relative to the US, so there was also a sense of free spirits, a sense of nonconformism, which weirdly was very much a factor of the left, but also of the right, because, again, it's hard for people from outside of Italy to understand this, but Italy is kind of like, or certainly was post-war, the ultimate uber-centrist nation, right? Always run by the same party, the Christian Democratic Party, which was a Catholic party, and so they liked to... So you would call them conservative in some ways, but on the other hand, they had a massive welfare state because Catholics, you know, being good Christians, believe in taking care of the less fortunate and so on. So it was kind of like this big amorphous blob in the middle. So the way you rebelled against that was by going to the far left or indeed the far right. So I think all of this was reflected in this group of players. And as James said, a lot of them were misfits, a lot of them out of control. I mean, I don't want to jump ahead, but to give you an idea, and I think one of the most tragic stories that I can think of was that of Luciano Rececconi. So I will now, having told you I don't want to jump ahead, jump ahead. That's okay. Yeah. So Luciano Recciacconi was, he was sort of the Billy Bremner, to stay in the era, of that team. You know, he was this sort of midfielder who ran around like a maniac. He had a big shock of blonde hair. He loved playing practical jokes. And this is 2 years after they won the title, or maybe even
following? Yeah, 77, January 77.
So he decides with a friend to go into a jewelry store where they're actually
I think they're with the third person. The other person actually wants to go and do some business, and they hang back. And
he's a friend of theirs.
Yeah,
the guy who they're with.
Yeah, because they all live in this neighborhood, which is the striking thing about it. And they go in there. I think it's a cold day, so they kind of zip up their jackets so their necks are up, got their hands in their pockets, and they go up. And there's a lot of conflicting reports as to what they said. I mean, the guy who ended up, the jeweler, who ended up shooting Recciacconi, thought he heard, stop, this is a robbery. But the guy who was with Recciacconi, Guedin, who is, I think he's still the manager of Malta, is he not?
I think so, yeah. Former Italian international.
Said he didn't hear anything like that. And because he had his hands in his pockets, this guy basically just took out his gun and shot him. I think it's a very weird case there. So I think there's a lot of unanswered questions about
The famous quote is, it was only a joke, it was only a joke, that supposedly is Recciacconi's last words, which suggests that he was. I mean, most accounts have him trying to give a bit of a scare to the jewellery shop.
I mean, with other conspiracies in Italy, so maybe there was something else behind it. I would assume generally most people don't just go and shoot somebody for no reason whatsoever.
I mean, the context of this jeweler basically had been burgled a couple of times. He'd actually already shot one guy. So when he was taken into jail whilst this case was going on, they had to put him in solitary confinement because he feared retribution from the guy who tried to burgle him in the past. And also, you know, there was Lazio Ultras supposedly with connections in the jail who could get to him. But you also, as the political context of all this, Liani di Piombo, you have sort of people applying for gun permits in Italy. 1960, only 20,000. 1974, it jumps to 98,000. In 1976, it's 125,000. You know, how well armed? You talk about gun culture in the States at the moment. This Lazio team, for example, you know, when they went into Ritiro before the games and they had that shooting range, and just the range of weapons they had, M16s, elephant rifles, stuff like this. It's just absolutely bonkers. And the thing is,
it's normal to build a shooting range at the training ground. I mean, I think Mourinho's got one at Carrington.
Yeah, and they got visited by the police one day because opposite the shooting range was a centre for disabled kids with special needs. They'd found a bullet lodged into the wardrobe of one of these kids' dorm rooms because it had travelled from the range across the street into this place. But as I was saying, basically jewellers were always getting burgled, usually to finance terrorism. And the thing is, no one would insure them because they were so regularly getting burgled. Insurers were paying out all the time, so they were making a loss on it. This is why you've got this very, I suppose, highly strung owner of a jewellery store. And this tragedy happens because of that, I suppose.
And this is barely a month after the man who, the architect of Lazio's rise and then their Scudetto win, Tommaso Maestrelli, dies of terminal cancer, diagnosed while he was still Lazio manager about 18 months before.
I mean, Maestrelli, by all accounts, and I remember speaking to Giorgio Chinaglia about him, and Chinaglia said, you know, he's the only guy who ever understood me. The only guy in football, I should say. By all accounts, he was sort of this father figure who knew how to keep them just wound up to just the right amount. Even though the team, you know, they were the ultimate bad boys and colorful and whatever, the amazing thing about it is they were deeply, deeply split into factions. You had one faction led by Pino Wilson and Giorgio Chinaglia, and then you had what you might call the fascist faction, even though Giorgio Chinaglia himself has certainly right-wing leanings, which was led by Martini and guys like that. And on Thursdays back then, it was customary in Italy, you know, you'd kind of have like a full scrimmage. As the story goes, back then, shin pads weren't mandatory in Serie A, but Maestrelli made sure that they were mandatory for the Thursday inter-squad scrimmages, because basically these things, because Quinaglia was just such an enormous bully, and because Martini kept his guns locked away, these games would go on until Quinaglia's team drew or won. And there were regularly fights breaking out, and it got really, really, I mean, there was some serious, serious acrimony. And the way he managed to keep it together on the pitch, and he got them to produce as a collective, is just remarkable. And they tell a great story where I think they were playing against Verona, and this was after a particularly bad week, and they're losing, I think it was 2-1 at halftime. They're at home, it's a packed stadium, the crowd are murmuring. You know, they're kind of getting on the players' backs because they can tell the players are shouting at each other. They really don't like each other. So they come off the pitch and they go towards the dressing room. And Maestrelli is standing in front of the dressing room and he's saying, like, no, you guys are going to turn around and you're going to walk back out onto the pitch. There's no halftime for you. And so they all kind of wander up back out on the pitch and the whole crowd's like, what's going on? All of a sudden, the crowd just starts cheering and just singing their names and whatever. And the players say, my God, you know, we're not going to screw this up just because we hate each other. Let's put this to one side. And second half starts, and within 7 minutes, they've scored 3 goals, and they're on their way.
I mean, that was a psychological masterstroke from Maestrelli, because the reason why he stood in front of the dressing room door is because he knew if they got into the dressing room, they would just tear each other to pieces.
Yeah.
But Maestrelli, I mean, he's a great story in himself, because this is, you know, Lazio's first title-winning manager, former captain of AS Roma. Albeit in their worst period, and
that's why they liked them.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, he had been a player in the past. He was playing, I think, in the second division with Bari when the Second World War broke out, and had to go and fight in Yugoslavia. And his company, I think, one day was ambushed, and yeah, he became a prisoner of war.
Right.
For a year. I think he was also hurt during the conflict. I think he was hit by shrapnel. Broke his tibia and his right foot, which for a player in those days could have ended his career. And, you know, made his way back, I think, what, in 1944, resumed his football career, and seems to have been loved by these players. I mean, I think Gab and I were just talking about, you know, watching some of the clips from this era on YouTube, and you see some of the players just break down talking about him in tears. And Quinaglia, who obviously, you know, went and made his career in the US, and went to live there afterwards. Yeah, that his family had his body brought back to Italy, and he's buried beside Maestrelli.
Really?
Yeah, in 2012.
Wow. Yeah. So tragedy was to await them, both of the death of Maestrelli and Ray Cecconi. Long John Quinaglia left before Cecconi died, actually, in 76.
He abandoned them. I mean, he abandoned them when Maestrelli comes back. After obviously contracting this terminal cancer, you know, after about, I think, what, maybe 9 months, he basically comes to save the team, which are in at risk of relegation. I think they were bottom of the table when he comes back. Quinaglia, who in this time had really fallen out with the guy who stood in
for Corsini,
yeah, for Maestrelli, because Maestrelli essentially treated Quinaglia like he was his son, like he was different from everybody else. Corsini treated Quinaglia like he was just anybody, and obviously Quinaglia did not like that at all. But Maestrelli comes back, and Quinaglia just flees. I mean, that's the way they say it. It wasn't a case that he already had a deal. He fled to go and join the Cosmos. He had to
with Pelé and Beckham,
yeah.
And which then also apparently inspired a song as well. Was it the Rino Gaetano, where he says, you know, the song has a line, which is, "My brother's an only child." Which is apparently
a great film, by the way.
Great film.
Yeah.
You know, directly referring to Giorgio Quinaglia.
Listeners, if you want to combine your knowledge of the footy with your knowledge of the footsie, then you need to get yourself over to the football stock market, Football Index. Football Index is a new way to profit from your knowledge of Serie A, the Premier League, and beyond. Buy and sell players, build a portfolio, earn dividends, and sell at a profit. Because you listen to Go Lazio, you can try Football Index and trade up to £1,000 entirely risk-free. Just head to footballindex.co.uk, enter the promo code TOTALLY, and if you don't love Football Index, you'll get a full refund with their 7-day money-back guarantee. download the app, or play online at footballindex.co.uk and become a football trader today. T&Cs apply. You must be over 18. Deposit required. And please trade responsibly.
Before all the tragedy struck, you had the 73-74 season, and the YouTube clips are there. But, I mean, I never really saw them play. People say they play great football. Gab, did you ever see any proper matches of theirs?
How old do you think I am?
No, no. What I mean, I don't, I mean, not being there, but did you ever, I don't know.
No,
ever...
you only see YouTube highlights.
All right, they seem to be, as you say, a pretty advanced team.
They do.
For that era. But you don't hear much about them. And part of the reason for that is the European ban they had because of what happened against Ipswich.
Now, Bobby Robson's Ipswich.
And the enormous brawl that broke out in November in Rome when Ipswich, who were 4-0 up after the first leg, came to the Olympico, and Lazio were well up for it. I mean, 2-0 up.
One of the reasons was because a Roma supporters delegation had been to see Ipswich and a hotel the night before the game, and they obviously had no idea who these guys were, and they came in and had a photographer with them, and they basically made them honorary Romanisti for the disservices that they'd done to Lazio.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, so that whipped things up quite a lot.
So the accounts are wildly different. Lazio's accounts tend to involve the referee being drunk and a succession of really dubious refereeing decisions which cost them.
And judge for yourself. Obviously, okay. The way this is cut doesn't have every incident. I mean, yeah. What's nice is they lost the first leg 4-0. If you were to lose the first leg 4-0 today, unless you're Barcelona...
Deportivo La Coruña against Milan.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying you'd put out a shadow side.
Right.
But it's really hard psychologically to get into that sort of mind frame. But back then, football was different. I mean, they didn't know who the hell Ipswich were, Bobby Robson. You know, you didn't have satellite television. There was no internet back then. It was just some team that had beaten them 4-0, and they said, you know, guys, yeah, we can really do it. We can come back. I mean, today, and I know it only happened last season, but today, you know, it takes something truly extraordinary. Back then, people really thought that they could do this. And so,
well, they couldn't, as it turned out. But it did seem like they could when they went 2-0
up. 2-0
up
after 10 minutes.
2-0 up after 10 minutes, and then an Ipswich player saved the ball on the goal line. The YouTube highlights, it does look like he handled it. It looks like he actually punches it out. And Lazio say their biggest complaint is they talked to the referee, and the referee was slurring his speech. And I always wonder, actually, in general, when players talk to the referees and they have these animated discussions.
In what language is it?
In what language? Because I... whatever. That's a whole other thing. But so that got them more wound up. And then Brian Hamilton, who, of course, is Danny Welbeck's dad, cheated to win a penalty. No, just kidding. See Brian out of it. But then the real flashpoint was later. Was it a...
Well, there was a penalty given.
Ipswich get a penalty.
Yeah.
And I think it's Oddi, who basically bundles this guy. Well, he doesn't... He says, I didn't touch him. And he just fell over. Yeah. And Ipswich put the penalty away.
Right. It's Welbeck Senior.
It's Welbeck Senior.
Let me recycle the Welbeck joke.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so maybe Welbeck, they had grounds for it, or maybe they didn't, but the result was one of the biggest brawls that you've ever seen in a European game.
Which continued in the players' tunnel. I have a lot of sympathy for Ipswich, because back then, there was no Ryanair either. You know, you went to Europe back then. You went to the continent. It was scary and different, and nobody spoke English.
Yeah, and
their
fans
They're surrounded by these lunatics, and I'm pretty sure they didn't bring their guns into the stadium that day, but, you know, Giorgio Chinaglia could be a pretty scary guy whether he was packing or not.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, there's that Rome derby, which Gab alluded to earlier, where basically Chinaglia, before the game, he's in the tunnel and he goes into the Roma dressing room, just knocks on the door, opens it, and he goes, I'll see you all outside. And that was basically it all started from there, really.
I'd love it if Paul Pogba did that. Pep's team. No, seriously. And I bet Mourinho would too. But he does it, and then they win the derby. There's like twice the allowed legal capacity at the Stadio Olimpico. Everybody's going nuts. There's a million cops. Common sense prevails. The Lazio players say, okay, we've won. Let's go to our dressing room and celebrate. Maestrelli's getting everybody back. Okay, there's Frustalupi. There's Ricciacconi. There's this one.
Well, also, because they're getting like pelted. The Lazio players are getting pelted by oranges, coins, bottles, and everything.
It's just totally unsafe. So all you want to do is just get your guys back before anybody reacts foolishly or pulls out a gun. And he's like, everybody, okay, head count, everybody's here. Wait, where's Chinaglia? And you look up. And as this is going on, Chinaglia runs the length of the pitch to the Roma Curva, right under the Roma Ultras. And he runs past them with his index finger up in the air, which became kind of like the ultimate insult to the mainstream. Because, you know, within Rome, Roma are kind of the establishment. Only one person since then has ever dared do that. And that, of course, was one Paolo Di Canio, who, of course, because he's Di Canio, did it when he was still a teenager after scoring in a derby. But that's a whole, that's an argument. It's a discussion for another time. But safe to say, I think Paolo would have fit in pretty well in this team. Yeah.
All right. So that Lazio team, why is it because they didn't get to play the European Cup because of the ban that they got for this mini riot with Ipswich? Is it because of him telling the Italy manager to vaffanculo? Why is that Lazio, and especially Canalia, not more well known internationally? A legend for Lazio fans.
I think certainly European ban had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, those were 3 years that they didn't get to win in Europe. And as history tells us, you know, who won in those 3 years? The evil German Empire of Bayern Munich, right? Raphael Honigstein wouldn't be running around quite so smug had it not been for Brian Hamilton and that game against Ipswich.
Well, that's
But I think it's partly that. There is this whole sort of bittersweet notion of what could have been if they'd been a little bit more sane. And Maestrelli believed in them. Remember, after 74 World Cup, Italy were terrible. They stunk
it up. So the 74 World Cup itself is worth mentioning, because Italy go into that as massive favourites, like one of the favourites. And Germany, as you say.
Yeah, they were finalists in 1970.
Right. They hadn't conceded a goal in almost 2 years with Zoff between the posts. And their first game is against Haiti, and everybody's, well, we're going to rock this one.
Yeah.
And what happens?
They won 3-1, but after going a goal down.
Yeah. Again, that's the match when Canalia is taken off by Valcareggi and tells the entire bench to F themselves.
Yeah, it was not really a good thing to do, especially back then, and it still is today. Italian football is actually fairly militarized. We don't really go for sort of the nonconformist type. Not a smart thing to do. Then Italy lost to Poland, and they drew with somebody else, I think, and they went out. After that World Cup, you know, they're like, what are we going to do? They offered the national team job to Maestrelli, and it was just pretty remarkable, and you think, because you knew that Maestrelli was going to bring Canalia back, but that's how desperate they were, and that was the respect in which they held Maestrelli, saying, like, all right, we're going to rip it up for you, you can come here, you can even bring that Canalia chap back, and you're going to make this work because we've got some good young players. We know we're good. You're the missing link. And instead, what does Maestrelli do? He says no. He stays at Lazio, which I think just really unbelievable, and tells you a lot about the sort of person he was and the relationship he had with the club and with those players.
One of the reasons why they're not maybe as well known as they perhaps should have been is because, relatively speaking, they flamed out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
They get promoted, you know, within what, 6 years of winning the league title, they're back in the second division, relegated in the Calcio Scommessi scandal. That figurehead of theirs, you know, Maestrelli, you know, dies what in 1976. Had been suffering a long illness, and their heads, I would say, were elsewhere. They were thinking about him. Whoever came in for him, he was never their guy.
Plus, as you say, Canalia had meanwhile done one to the States. His wife's American. And I think he also has said that part of the reason was he was scared of kidnapping, of being kidnapped.
Yeah,
and he decided so many different things in different times. I mean, I got to know him a little bit. I thought he was a remarkable person in many different ways. Someone who's had a lot of time to reflect on many choices he made in his career that maybe he could have made different choices, and maybe things might have ended up better, but. I think the combination of that and Recciacconi's passing as well, which really was just such a shock. You know, again, whether you buy the conspiracy, whether you really think it's just sheer dumb luck, sent them horrific luck. And yeah, it certainly sent them on their way.
So he goes off to New York, plays alongside Pele, and Bin Canalia tells him to do a bit more work.
No, he really did.
Yeah.
Well, but the thing about Canalia is, even if you don't like him, I mean, all right, for those who've never seen him and those who don't know, I sort of wondered, you know, what is he like? And I've had this discussion with Canalia, and he disagreed with everything I suggested.
Right.
I generally think of a Christian Vieri type, because he sort of had sort of this huge upper body and sort of this hunchback.
Yeah.
He was extremely mobile, and he wasn't just a target man. You know, he would pop up on the wing and so on. He set up Fabio Capello's goal in 1973 at Wembley, the first time Italy beat England at Wembley. So, yeah, maybe a cross between Christian Vieri and somebody who worked harder than Vieri.
I mean, the other issue about Canalia and his legacy.
Who also ended up in the States, Christian Vieri.
Who's in the States now? He's in Miami.
Yeah. But I wonder how much of his nonconformity.
And who also grew up abroad.
Yeah.
In Australia.
There we go.
So true. So the other thing about Canalia and his legacy is the fact that, A, there was a black mark against him for leaving. And secondly, he made various returns. Now, I actually met him a couple of times in the early 90s when he was kind of being wheeled out by Lazio as a club symbol to welcome Paul Gascoigne, with whom it was felt he would have a certain affinity, both coming from British backgrounds. Yeah. And also a certain, perhaps, mentality.
I wonder how much of that mentality did come from growing up in Wales in what, the 60s? Because, you know, when he's playing in, what, third division for Swansea, and, yeah, his dad and his dad's best mate basically look at him and think, yeah, you can do better than this. Let's get you back to Italy.
Well, he also had his national service, I believe.
Yeah, but, like, he gets this contract with this club in the third division, and basically they send him this letter, and it's like, this is what we expect of you. And, you know, he goes over and he does the pre-season, and it's very monastic, you know, it's that classic Italian training camp where you have to be up at this point, we're going to do this much running, you need to be in bed by this time, you can only eat this, you can only drink that. And yeah, this guy sort of in Cardiff and in Swansea had been used to sort of, you know, going out to the pubs, you know, smoking, drinking with his teammates. This Italian culture, even though he was born in it, it was completely alien to him. No, it's, yeah, that non-conformity, I think, again, it's not only because he was a particular personality, but because of, you know, where he was brought up, I suppose.
So out he trots in the early 90s for various things with Paul, and he's still involved with the club at that time. But then after Craniotti goes and Lotito takes over, things get quite bitter. He'd already been Lazio president back in the 80s, no? Not with any great success.
83, 84.
Then after the year 2000... when the fans are unhappy, or there are moves to bring in a takeover bid for Lazio, Canalia is chosen as the front man and ends up having to leave the country because there's quite serious allegations about the money behind this, or the people behind this, being either organised crime or money launderers. And he disappears back to the States and never returns, and dies ultimately there, aged only 65 in 2012.
It was a Hungarian pharmaceutical company.
That's right.
As I recall.
Yeah.
When I spoke to him, he said, maybe I was tricked and I wanted to believe them, but to this day, I don't think that there's a strong case to be made that they're not genuine. When it comes to the ultras, who, you know, at that point were threatening Claudio Lotito, because obviously no sane person with a heart or a soul can like Claudio Lotito, just not possible, right? So, but the Lazio ultras were thinking, oh, these guys have money and so on. Some of those ultras have some dubious links. It got so to the point where people were basically accusing Canalia of fomenting the ultras to essentially shake down Lotito so that Lotito would sell at a knockdown price. Now, Lotito wouldn't sell you his used toilet paper at a knockdown price, so why you would think that this was going to work, you know, because Lotito's not scared of anything.
And the reason why they were going with the ultras was because Lotito was taking their privileges away. And they'd had very handsome privileges under Craniotti when it came to selling merchandise, from getting tickets. And yeah, Lotito, I think still to this day, has police protection after what had gone on in those days.
He's had a different set of threats against
him. He was being sent bullets in the post.
I don't think at that stage of his life, Canalia was doing this for personal enrichment or anything nefarious or to get one over on Lotito. I mean, I think his intentions, and again, maybe I've been totally fooled. He's passed on. We don't know. But certainly Giorgio Canalia, I knew and spoke to, really stuck to me as somebody who knew he'd screwed up. But he said, you know, I was taken for a ride. You know, I was used. I believe them, and I shouldn't have.
Well, a lot of bad choices along the way, but also one particularly glorious period of football, which he played such a big part of, and we'll close off this section then with Lazio's very own salute to their first ever Scudetto. Fino a ieri, nostra Lazio, per noi altri era nostra Lazio, ora stiamo tra di meglio.
palla, Benedetto tenta di recuperarla, finita la partita. Sono le 17.45 del 12 maggio, la Lazio che ha battuto il Foggia, in misura su rigore è campione d'Italia, da tutti i settori del campo convergono verso il centro i tifosi che hanno atteso per mesi.
Listeners, it's time to talk about shaving. It's time to talk about Harry's. Harry's have got everything you need for a high-quality shave at a better price. Their cucumber and aloe shave gel lathers into a luxurious foam, allowing their German-engineered blades to glide across your face. These blades sit in a non-slip handle with a textured grip for extra precision, and Harry's post-shave balm will leave you extra cool and fresher than ever. Because you listen to Galazzo, you can get a special Harry's trial set, including that aforementioned handle, and your choice of blue, orange or green, a five-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover. You'll get all of that delivered to your door for just £3.95, and it doesn't come in an envelope or a jiffy bag. It comes in a Harry's branded cardboard box. And if that cardboard box isn't enough to incentivize you, if you don't love your first shave with Harry's, you'll get your money back. Find out more at harrys.com/golazzo. That's golazzo with one L and two Zs.
That's the sound of us fast-forwarding to the very current times of 2018. And last weekend in Serie A, which saw some interesting things, Milan continuing their great domestic run.
Second best record in the league in 2018.
Wow. Yeah. Inter solidifying their claim on a top four spot. With a whopping, because we were previewing Sampdoria Inter and how strong Samp are at home and that, Inter go there and win 5-0 with four goals from Mauro Icardi. Boom.
You know, Inter without Icardi is kind of like Wham without George Michael.
Yeah, that's so true. They're fourth, 1 point clear of Lazio now with a game in hand. Milan 5 points behind them. And I think the other thing that's worth mentioning, well, there's probably loads of other things, but definitely the top, the fact that I think people maybe thought, oh, Juve have gone 4 points clear, here we go. But now it's back to just two with the clash between Napoli and Juventus still to come. And I was reading in today's Gazzetta that Maurizio Sarri's record in spring is much better, almost twice as good as Allegri's record in spring, often because Allegri's dealing with European issues at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And I suppose Milan have an opportunity to be kingmakers in this. Ooh. Because they still have to play Juventus. They still have to play Napoli. I think Juve have got the tougher run in, not only because they've got a couple of legs against Real Madrid at the very least to contend with. I think the first one is after the game against against Milan, but they still
plus
have to play
the final against Manchester City.
Yeah, and they've still got to play the Derby d'Italia against against Inter. I think that's at San Siro where they lost last year. And this Napoli game. So Juve obviously have a very good track record of managing leads, but this certainly isn't over.
But we're going to have to wait for the next instalment of the Lotto Scudetto because it's International Week, an International Week which features two prestige friendlies for Italy.
Both in England.
Both in England. So get along, if you will, to Wembley next Tuesday to see them take on the Three Lions.
Yeah, where Di Biagio is hoping to do a Southgate. You know, he wants to become the permanent manager of the national team.
Nice.
You know, that's his inspiring example.
Di Biagio, who's taken over from Ventura. But his first game will be on Friday, this coming Friday, at the Etihad in Manchester, as the Azzurri take on Argentina. Two games, I think it's safe to assume, were made with a view to warming up for their World Cup participation, and it's kind of obviously not worked out that way for Italy.
In fact, Argentina tried to cancel.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, because Italy hadn't qualified, and they were worried that Italy were going to send a shadow squad filled with kids, and it wasn't going to be proper preparation.
Well, it is a squad filled with a certain number of kids, isn't it?
Gigi Buffon.
Gigi Buffon. Yeah.
Like seriously, I mean, this has caused a lot of debate about what you should do in these situations,
right?
Given that Gigi Di Biagio coached the under-21s, I would have wanted him to be like, all right, just call up all the under-21s. If you want to bring in a couple old guys to get some cheapo caps, that's fine. But you're not going to be the long-term manager.
You think he's not?
I don't think so. But your best case is to go and bring in kids and show that the kids can hold their own, at least on paper, in friendlies against Argentina and England. Then bring in the veterans who, I mean, I'm sorry, okay, Giorgio Chiellini, of course, picked up a mystery injury, so he's not there. But like, if you were one of those guys, Are you going to be thinking about the Champions League and the title run-in and qualifying for top four? Or are you going to be thinking...
Yeah, but all players will this weekend, no?
I know, but the under-21 guys...
would at least be fighting.
But I think so.
If you port the
entire
team...
And it's a good under-21 team.
Yeah, but if you port them in just en masse, isn't there a danger of them being a little bit out of their depth?
I don't need to see Darmian play for Italy. You know, I really don't. I know what he brings to the... I'm not making fun of him. He's not playing for Manchester United. Uh-huh. But I know what he brings to the table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think people want to see something different. Some people who will be part of the future.
So, he's brought in... Who's there? Cristante, Cutrone, Pellegrini, Chiesa. There's various other options who would be there, I think, arguably, if they weren't injured or... in inverted commas. Or Bernadeschi, Romagnoli, Caldara, Conti.
One of the big debates is... is a situation with Buffon.
Mm.
Mino Raiola came out and in a very Mino Raiola way, because obviously Buffon standing in the way of Donnarumma. And there's this argument which I hate, which really, really bugs me, which says, oh, look, he's only 9 games away from the all-time appearance record, which is held by some Saudi guy nobody's ever heard of. He already has the record within Europe. I mean, why don't we just keep Gigi around? And I say, first of all, that's humiliating towards Gigi. Second of all, it gets in the way of other goalkeepers who actually will be around long term. Third of all, I don't think there's any argument, as much as I love him, that he's Italy's number one goalkeeper on merit right now, leaving aside going forward the future. I'm all for sentimentalism, but not now.
What do you think about the rest of the team, the squad?
Well, I think the other big debating point is the fact that Mario Balotelli is not in the squad again, even though...
Mino Raiola, funny enough, it's something to say about that, too.
It's funny that these Raiola clients either get overlooked or just not picked at all. But I think Balotelli deserves to be there on merit. And you have all these managers now, Ventura and also Di Biagio, who've been asked about them and have made sort of reassuring noises about picking him, almost given the impression that they were going to do it and then don't do it. It's getting to the point where it's just bizarre because, for what he's done over the last 2 years.
Mm. The suggestion would be that particularly after the last World Cup, there was a strong
feeling.
4
years ago.
Yeah, but there was
those guys are gone.
But when some of them aren't, Gigi Buffon for a start.
And some of them have been very keen to say, we'd have him back.
Okay, but just to finish off, the notion would be that he was such a disruptive presence that whatever he might have done at various clubs in which where there may have been allowances made, when he's been with Italy in the past, it hasn't worked out. And therefore, because the chemistry of a team is a huge thing... As it was under Ventura. I guess that would be the argument. I would love to see him back in an Azzurri shirt. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. Because at the moment, these are just friendlies.
I'm pretty sure he was 4 years younger 4 years ago. I can't be 100% certain, but I'm pretty sure. And then he might have evolved a little bit.
Sure.
And really, in the last 12 months, I mean, he had a few issues at the beginning in Nice,
mm-hmm.
but he's generally been on very good behavior on and off the pitch.
Have you heard any of these crazy Balotelli stories that we used to find all the time in the tabloids over here, which may or may not have been true?
He was the subject of one of those sort of practical joke shows with a hidden camera called Scherzi a Parte. I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but like he meets this other like African guy who's introduced to his Mario's brother's internet. The guy ends up like stealing his car and his mobile phone, and he drives around Milan picking up like fake prostitutes and stuff. And Mario has to hunt him down. And in the end,
elaborate.
I mean, it's remarkable the way they did it with hidden cameras or whatever. Just when you expect Mario to just lose it. And go and just destroy this guy after he crashes Mario's car and everything. He just breaks out laughing and starts hugging everybody, including the fake hooker and stuff. I mean, it's pretty remarkable stuff.
All right. Oh, good. It's a shame. I'd love to see more of that in the Italian national side. But the team that will be taking to the field against whoever Argentina pick on Friday, are you excited? Are you in optimism about this? There's a lot of talk in the papers about it being an Italian spring, etc.
Well, there was talk about this last summer when the under-21s went and played at the Euros, and it is a very good under-21 side. That's why, basically, Di Biagio should, I think, just have had a continuity squad selection with the team that he's been playing pretty much with the under-21s. Because that team is familiar with each other. They've spent an entire summer together, rooming, training together.
We should see. That's coming up on Friday anyway, then England on Tuesday, which is always a fun game. And so many memories. But maybe they'll be for another time. Maybe next week when we'll be meeting again the day after the Wembley clash. Yeah, we can talk about that then if you want. I'm sure there's loads of other things we can discuss as well. We'll have a think about what they might be. And then we'll be back here on Wednesday week. So I do hope you'll join us, listeners. Many thanks, Gabriele.
Pleasure. We're all going to be a week older in a week's time.
Yeah, but wiser. We will have evolved a whole 7 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Mario.
Like, yeah. And also to you, Mr. Horncastle.
Uh-huh.
And you, listeners. We'll see you next week. For now, it's arrivederci.
You've been listening to Golazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Game of Our Lives is a new podcast series hosted by the football historian David Goldblatt. The first episode is out now and focuses on the cinema of the pitch. Here's a taster with filmmaker Werner Herzog giving his view of your typical Super Sunday from a cinematographer's perspective.
I like to see a wider shot of the field and how the entire field all of a sudden is moving. What is the opponent's team doing? How do they move their entire team a little bit more to the left or to the right? So I like to see certain patterns that emerge very quickly.
If you want to learn more about why football matters, make sure you listen to Game of Our Lives on Apple Podcasts and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.